Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Vestai Vampyr and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And today we are going to be looking at two installments from Keith R.A. DeCandido. The first one is, and I hope that I pronounced this correctly, Lodmi Puvavuye.
Sound probably right? Close enough.
Close enough, okay. And that is a short story that is contained in a collection of short stories called Tales from the Captain's Table.
You want to mention why Keith has this, or why it's in that book?
Yeah, it apparently is a collection of short stories that captains tell in a bar, and this is a celestial bar of some sort that is outside of the physical realm. And captains can choose to go here and have drinks and tell each other tales. And only captains are allowed unless they bring their first officers with them as guests. So this particular...
But
go ahead.
Also, the point here is Keith said he was editing these two volumes. This is actually the second volume of the Captain's Table stuff. He was editing these two volumes and discovered he hadn't made a contribution, a short story for the collection.
No.
So he decided, yeah, I suppose I better write one. And that's how this story came into be.
Yeah. And the whole concept is, as I said, it's this metaphysical bar that exists outside of time. So anybody can walk in at any time, at any point in their lifetime or whatever, and leave, and they have to tell a story after so long. And that is kind of the shell that is around each and every tale in the book. Now, I haven't read the entire one, but I intend to read the whole book. I just, for the podcast, I read only Keith's story.
So basically one can say, though, quite factually, that you read the entire one.
Yes, the entire one story. The other book we're looking at is a novel, self-contained novel, called A Diplomatic Implausibility, also by Keith, and it's a good story. So, John, you want to give us a summary of these two in items that we're going to look at?
Before we do that, why are we doing two this time? Well, we're doing two this time because these two are setting up the trilogy of four books that we're going to be covering over the next few months. And it is the IKV Gorgon series that Keith put out.
Yes.
These two stories set that universe, set that set of events up, and the characters that are going to be going through the rest of the volumes are introduced to us, particularly in Diplomatic Implausibility.
It's a good setup. We're introduced to characters that we saw in Next Generation, so this would be a Next Generation novel. So if you want to give us a brief summary, John, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. From the back of the Tales of the Captain's Table, and this is generic for the entire set of short stories, from the weekly episodes of Star Trek Enterprise to the monthly adventures of SCE, from the best-selling Serpents Among the Ruins to the best-selling series New Frontier, from the past tales of Stargazer to the new stories of Titan, from the glorious exploits of the IKS Gorgon to the post-finale chronicles of DS9 and Voyager, come nine newest members of the Star Trek's finest and bravest captains. Clegg, son of Marok of the IKS Gorgon, as told by Keith R.A. DeCantio. Now, I have to say that, you know, we read all this, but the actual story is only like 20 pages long.
Yeah, it's about 15, 20 minutes to read.
It's a shorty.
Yeah.
From the back of Diplomatic Implausibility, now we're talking a full-length novel here. 200 years ago, the expanding Klingon Empire found a frozen world rich in deposits of the mineral topoline. They named the planet Todd, the Klingon word for frozen, and they called the people Jekpuwe, or conquered. 4 years ago, the Klingon Empire invaded Cardassia, breaching the Kittimer Accords and causing a break with the Federation. On Tad, depleted Klingon forces were overthrown in a small coup d'etat, and the victorious rebels took advantage of the disruption to appeal for recognition from the Federation. Now, the Klingons have returned to Todd and reestablished their control. But the stubborn rebels insist on Federation recognition. A solution to the diplomatic impasse must be found. A task that falls to the Federation's new ambassador to the Klingon Empire, Worf. Worf thinks of himself as a fighter, not a negotiator. But the Federation disagrees. And now, for the sake of the Federation and the Empire, a Klingon warrior must weave a fragile peace out of a situation ripe for war.
Mm-hmm. So, two very, very good stories. So, are we going to start with the one from the collection first?
It's an interesting question, because which one comes first?
Okay, it's interesting you bring that up, because we had talked about this and have been kind of a little bit of back and
kicking
forth.
Kicking around ideas to try and figure this question out.
Yeah.
If you look at the publication dates, the short story came out in June 2005. The novel came out in February 2001. But there's references in the novel to the bar.
Uh-huh. Well, you know,
but you go to the bar and you read the story, and Clegg has the arm reattached like it happens at the end of the novel.
Uh-huh.
So which one's the chicken and which one's the egg?
Well, you know, and I thought about that. And after I finished reading these two stories, I have come to the conclusion, and I don't know, maybe you might consider this a cop-out or not, but it does not matter what order they come in because of the nature of the bar.
Yeah, except at the end of the bar story, who is the other Klingon in the bar?
Aha, yes, that's Doric, Clegg's brother.
By the time the Gorgon series starts, he and his brother are bitter enemies.
Oh, yes. They are definitely not getting along and playing well together. So people can walk in and out. It doesn't matter where in the timeline they exist. Now, to get down to the nuts and bolts of it, I guess we'll talk about Lodni Pu Vavpu Ye. We'll talk about that one first. Okay, it doesn't matter where this falls. Everybody can walk in and out as they want, depending on where they exist in the timeline. So, or they walk out of different parts of the timeline. I mean, you could probably get a young Captain Picard or whatever. But anyway, the story that Clegg tells is far different than the story that he would normally tell, or what we would expect. So what would you expect if Clagg walked into the bar and started telling a story?
That, frankly, is a plot point in the short story.
It is.
It turns out that anytime Clagg is asked to tell a story, he's telling the story of Mercan 4, I believe it was, where his ship was destroyed on the planet. He lost his arm, and he was able to defend himself and take out several Jem'Hadar warriors along with their Vorta.
Yes.
It got to the point where even the bartender was saying, "You've told that story before. Don't you have any others?"
One of the other patrons in the bar says, "Then the number of Jem'Hadar
keeps going up.
What are you up to now? 2 dozen? Well, we know that it was 7, for sure."
And an interesting point is, one of the things in diplomatic implausibility that leads Clagg to decide he needs a replacement arm is he finally stops running his holographic recreation of the battle on the easiest mode and tells the computer to run it like a real simulation.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets trounced every time.
Yeah, he does. He gets killed every time. So, you know, the fortunes of battle at the time, you know, I'm sure this will come up again, but he runs the battle, but he does not feel that he has the same amount of urgency on the holodeck as he did in the actual battle, which that extra edge gave him the ability to beat 7 Jem'Hadar soldiers with one arm.
Yeah. Whether it's an adrenaline rush, whether it's, you know, just I've got to do this, I don't have a choice, and on the holodeck is, well, you know, if they kill me, I'm just going to pop back up again anyway.
Right. So he's, you know, but back to the story.
The point here, Jim, is that these two stories are so interlinked that we're going to go back and forth on our discussion of the two.
I think we
will.
As to
what's going on.
Yeah. So we'll start with the Lodni Vavpuye story.
Sorry, I made you pronounce that again.
That's all right. I'll do it as many times as I need to. As long as it's in front of me, I can kind of figure it out. And I'm not pronouncing it correctly.
We have an hour show, so you're only going to be able to pronounce it 5 more times.
Yeah, only 5 more times. Okay. So what were your overall impressions?
It was a short story. It was a short story of reminiscing. Keith is a good writer. I like the way Keith writes. I like the stories that he brings up. But it was a short story. There could be no depth to what comes out of it. And I believe the stories that he was telling in this short story, we had heard through other media somewhere along the line. But I could be mistaken about that.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts?
Okay. Well, first of all, as I said before, doesn't matter what order the stories are in because of the nature of the venue that he's telling the story in. All right. That being said, here's what Dean Wesley Smith wrote in the introduction to that collection. It says, "The captain's table was built to float forever in time and space, allowing only captains of ships through the big wooden front doors." Okay. And it's a really fun story to read, but I think you kind of have to read it more than once to really get the meat off of the bones. So, and it's great. I mean, does Keith write anything that isn't great? I seriously doubt it. I've never read anything from him that wasn't just incredible.
Well, I think what you're going to find here, though, is that, at least to my way of thinking, diplomatic implausibility, I'm jumping ahead again, diplomatic implausibility was a okay story, but he's just getting up to speed, and the Gorkon series is a step above these two.
Yeah, and see, I'm wondering if this bar story maybe didn't come out of an outline or something that Keith had been working on to bring the Gorkon series to light. I'm sure he, you know, we know from talking to Keith that he plans his work and he plans it in advance. And so, you know, he may have already had those other stories in mind before. And he says, okay, I need something for this collection and this is what I'm going to do. So here's the way the story goes. Clegg starts out telling his typical story, and someone calls him on it and said, no, we don't want to hear that again. We want to hear another story. And he says, fine, here's another story. He actually tells three stories. Okay. And the first one is about him and his brother, very young, 6 years old and 5 years old, if I recall correctly, going on a hunt. And they're supposed to hunt a smaller animal, a targ or something like that. Well, they wind up hunting a very large Klongat, and they get mauled by the animal as they're killing it, but they finally bring it down because the two brothers, the two sons of Merak, which are, of course, Clegg and Doric, when they're together, they can accomplish anything. So the two young Klingons are very close at the beginning of their life. The second story is of another family where they had some scandal going on. The head of the household was killed by being stabbed in the back. Nobody's really sure who did that, but they know the Gintok from their house. The wife starts to have an affair with the Gintok, and they go all over the place looking to get revenge. The Gintok doesn't want anything to do with it. He wants to get out of it, and the wife is getting tired of the chase also, but honor will not let her give it up. And they see Clegg and Doric, older, sitting in a restaurant, and they approach them because apparently Clegg's ridges are very similar to the ridges of the person that supposedly did the killing or had somebody else do the killing. And when confronted, nothing happens. All right. So the third story Clegg tells is of a couple of brothers that are absolute fools. They don't obey instructions. They go hunting together. Sound familiar? They go hunting together for an animal that is too big for them. They shouldn't be hunting that at all, but they do it anyway. The head of their house gets captured by Romulans and held. Eventually, he does escape and makes it back. The older brother grows up, is a fool, and doesn't have anything to do with his father. The younger one goes off on his own, becomes a warrior. The two brothers grow apart, and they remain fools forever. But none of them lose their honor. Nobody in the story loses honor when there should have been honor lost by a lot of them, by probably all of them.
Well, you know that second story, Keith goes on to use in the Klingon Art of War.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does. I think the short story is more of a confession by Clegg of things that he would probably like to change in his life if he possibly could.
Rather than what I think we kind of hoped for was a set of glorious episodes that Clegg did and showing us just how Klingon storytelling brings out the glory of the events you participate in.
Yeah.
But Clegg is the type of character that can't do that because of all the time he spent on the ship as first officer.
The Pock.
Where he felt the captain was holding him back because the captain was politically tied to somebody who was way up in the Klingon hierarchy.
Clegg felt he should have challenged his captain from the Gorkon, but he was told that he should obey everything his captain tells him in order to maintain his honor. And then he took that as gospel, so to speak, and didn't do what he should have done and eliminated the dishonorable captain, which probably would have saved the ship from getting wrecked by the Jem'Hadar. So we find out here that Klingons can have regret for things that have happened to them, even without losing their honor.
Yeah, because and honor is a big thing to Clegg, because he's so worried. The last story about the father who became prisoner and escaped is all about his own father and how Clegg is agonizing about how he feels his father has decided not to reclaim his honor after escaping the prison camp by going back into service. His father is accepting his dishonor for being held a prisoner.
Yes, and he's just given up. His father's given up. I mean, even in the episode where we first see him, Matter of Honor, he does express that he wants nothing to do with his father because his father is just sitting at home waiting to die.
Because his father has decided to take the dishonorable path and not continue being the warrior that he still has a chance to be.
Mm-hmm. So we get a story of some regret from a Klingon, which is way out of left field. I would have never expected to see anything like that.
Actually, you could almost say we got three stories of regret.
Yes.
Because the lady in charge of the household and her Gintog trying to catch the assassin of her husband is a tragic story in that they never accomplish their mission. And the story about the hunt, the two boys are not rewarded for taking down the larger beast. They're scolded for not hunting what they were sent to hunt.
Yes. So, yeah, there it is. I mean, it's a circular story with Clegg more or less crying in his war knot or in his blood wine, which he has about 15 servings of, is what I understand.
Well, there's some debate there. Clegg has one number. The bartender has another number. So we're not really sure, but it's interesting. Clegg was originally going to go for a story that was a glorious adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was told not to, he picks these three tragic stories instead.
Yeah. So it makes me very curious about the collection, what the rest of the stories are. Are they going to be of captains confessing disappointment in themselves for things that they have done? I don't know, actually, but I'm going to read the rest of it to find out for sure, and probably pick up the first collection also in the Captain's Table series. So, should we move forward and talk about diplomatic implausibility, which is in English, and I can pronounce that?
No, let's go back, and there's these cavemen around a fire. One of them picks up a bone and tosses it as high as he can into the air.
And it turns into a space station. That's a, yes. No, I don't think we want to do that because this is not the 2001 Space Odyssey podcast. This is Bound by Honor.
In 2020, which is, you know, left 2001 way behind.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, dude, where's my flying car?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen soon. So at any rate, we move into this story about Worf, and this comes after he has been made This is at the end of, after the end of Deep Space Nine, where he is made ambassador to the Klingon Empire, the Federation ambassador to the Klingon Empire. So as you recall, Martok, originally, Worf killed Gowron, and Martok was there and said, "We're going to make you chancellor." And Worf said, "No, I am not going to be chancellor. You are going to be chancellor." And Worf put the great coat on Martok, making him chancellor. And then Worf became ambassador, and Martok was very, very happy about that, because he finally had an ambassador that he could go out hunting with. Previous to that, and this also becomes a big point in diplomatic implausibility, is that Martok took Worf into his house. Okay, so we have Worf of the House of Martok. We have Martok as chancellor appointing Worf. And now the Federation is sending Worf in to handle a situation with the Klingons and this Al-Hamati group that's in on this planet, Todd.
Because the Al-Hamati asked for the Federation to come in and do something.
The Al-Hamati want to get involved with the Federation and away from the Klingon Empire, but...
Actually, the Al-Hamati don't give a... rat's hoot about the Federation. They just want to have some wedge to get rid of the Klingons.
Right. They don't want the Klingons around anymore. And judging from what you see, you can't really blame them. Now, this point where in Worf's position automatically makes trouble for him. Clagg does not like Worf because he believes that Worf has been chosen by means of nepotism.
Well, how did Captain Kargan become captain of the Paw, in Clagg's opinion?
Well, it was nepotism also.
By nepotism.
Right.
So he sees this guy coming in who's, okay, you know, he's not in charge of your ship, but he's in charge of the mission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and frankly, the way I've always seen it written in other stories regarding where you've got a captain and an admiral working on the same ship, the captain controls the ship, but the admiral controls the mission.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a big deal. But apparently, in Klingon culture, that becomes a big deal.
Yes.
So there's this tension between Clagg and Worf.
Right, and there's more than just tension, because Clagg just thinks Worf is a loser from the word go. He was taken in by humans, raised by humans. He has not lived, in Clagg's opinion, as a Klingon his entire life. He only knows about Klingon customs through what he's read and what he's been told. And Clagg does not like this, because Clagg has earned his position. He doesn't feel that Worf has earned anything.
Oddly enough, because of the nepotism question, the only thing that Worf has going for him, in Clagg's opinion, is he served with Riker.
Right. And Riker tells Clagg right off the bat, he goes from the Enterprise as they're bringing Worf over. He goes over and tells Clagg, you know, hey, yeah, Worf's good. Worf's okay. You can trust this guy. He's a good Klingon. And Clagg is not convinced.
Well, I kind of get the impression that Clagg is convinced as long as Riker's in the area.
Ah.
But then all of his suspicions start ganging up on Clagg again, and he's back to his original opinion of Worf.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Clagg and Worf's conflict is not the only conflict on this ship.
Oh, no.
Gene Roddenberry had a rule when he was doing Star Trek. There can be no discord on the ships. And he meant Federation, because they weren't dealing a lot with other races' ships. But mm-hmm. You couldn't have conflict. The Gorkon is just the opposite of this.
It's teeming with conflict.
Remember, we talked earlier that this book is introducing characters that are going to be found throughout the entire rest of the series. You've got a navigator, Liskit, who is kind of mouthy, kind of impertinent, kind of swaggery.
Kind of?
Yeah. And he's trying to seduce the chief of engineering.
Correct, yes.
And the chief of engineering has a member of her staff who apparently is fairly bright at fixing things.
Yeah.
And knowing when things need to get fixed before they break down, before they really become a problem. And she sees him as jumping the gun, trying to grab her glory. So she's all over him.
Yeah.
You've got the second officer of the ship is not very bright and cognizant. So the young boy from the Next Generation.
Talk.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the episode is what I was trying to do.
Yeah, I don't remember it.
He challenges and becomes, after a quick fight, you know, he becomes a second officer of the ship now. But here we're being introduced to a character from Next Gen who's also part of the crew. And everybody's having problems with Doric, who just happens to be Worf's memory erased brother.
Oh, that's Rodek.
Doesn't know who he is, doesn't really care, isn't really impressive at his job, but he's the gunner of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Clags makes often remarks about how this guy is not inspired, is not grabbing hold with gusto to take care of his mission. There's just conflict all over the Gorkon.
Yes. So, yeah. And Rodek, who is, you know, Worf's brother, he was mind wiped and given new memories, is just not taking up the mantle of being a warrior. And, you know, I'm sure it's a result of the mind wipe that he's just not really sure. And we're going to find that out in the Gorkon series, what happens with that.
And because Clag is looking at all of these people who are getting their positions through political connections, he keeps obsessing with the fact that he didn't get to choose any of his crew. In fact, his first officer is the son of Martok.
Yes, Drex.
Which is an inspiring name for a character, because he comes across as the Drex of Klingon humanity.
Well, Drex is definitely using his connection to his father to try to further himself. And as we recall on Deep Space Nine, on a Deep Space Nine episode, I got to start writing down what episodes are referenced here. There's a whole bunch of episodes referenced in Diplomatic Implausibility.
I think you're looking for The Way of the Warrior, which is where they introduce Worf to the series.
Ah, well, yeah, you're right. You're right. That would be that first episode with Worf, I think, beginning of the fourth season.
What's inspiring is that Drex doesn't bring the episode up.
No.
Drex had his Tatog taken away from him by Worf.
Uh-huh.
And he never brings that up to Worf.
No. Yeah, it's not his place.
Now, knowing Keith, that's not an oversight. That's intentional. It's just going to show the character of Drex not caring enough about his own honor, not caring about honor like his father and other members of his family are.
Yeah, which we find out at the end of the story, just how high he holds his honor, and what Clag tells him. Telling you need to go find your own honor. Don't look to get it from me or anybody else. Go earn it yourself. So, and he does finally get rid of Drex. Now, you mentioned Kurak earlier, who is a really interesting character. She is a chief engineer on the IKS Gorkon, a brand new ship, a huge brand new ship.
Which I don't know for sure, but I'm having to guess that she had a hand in designing, because she came from the, and wants to go back to, the Klingon School of Design.
Yeah, that was her passion, was designing ships, and she winds up serving on this one, which she is just, she's unhappy about. She doesn't want anything to do with it.
She's only there because some member of her family, of her household, must serve in the Klingon Defense Force, and all her male relatives are either killed or not old enough to serve yet.
Yeah, and she wants them out. She wants out of it. Yep, but she, by her and Leskett kind of find each other, and that's kind of a neat point. Now, let's talk a little bit about the conflict on the planet that brings Worf in. So the Klingons are in charge of this planet, mining that mineral.
The Topolene.
And it there isn't a whole lot of production on the planet. We have a governor, Trial, who is in a space station in orbit around the planet. And we have rebels attacking and killing a bunch of Klingons. And when Worf goes down to meet the leader, and his name is Megramot.
Keith needs to put more vowels in those names.
we just assume the vowels. Megramot. Worf meets him, and he says, "We love the Klingons here. We don't want anything to change. You know, I don't know where you're getting this idea, but we do have to get rid of these rebels." Now, the Al-Hamadi should be mentioned that this seems to be a race of sentient polar bears.
It's the reason the Klingons have to have this race mining the planet. The planet is too cold for Klingons, which, like, you know, hot climes compared to humans.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a change for them. They can't really function outdoors on the planet as well as they should. So they need this race that actually lives on the planet, adapted to the planet, to actually do the mining for them. So realistically speaking, they can't just wipe this race out. They can't even really move this race to another planet, like Worf thinks might be an idea to solve this particular crisis.
Yeah. Well, Worf says, you know, or Worf's, I should say, Worf's assistant, a guy named Wu, says, you know, why don't we just turn the planet over to the people and just leave? And that's not going to work out.
No, because if the Klingons leave a conquered planet, then the rest of the planets they've conquered can look on the victory of the Al-Hamadi and say, hey, we can do the same thing to the Klingons, and it's going to start a revolt throughout the Empire.
Right. If the Al-Hamadi wanted to get rid of the Klingons, or if they wanted to keep the Klingons, okay, and Martok says, hey, we're not getting anything out of this planet to begin with. It's not that big a deal. There's bigger sources out there. We're just going to leave. That would be acceptable. But since the Al-Hamadi are rebelling against their Klingon governor, Trial, who is ambitious by his own right and doesn't want to relinquish his position, it would be a slap in the face for the Klingons, and other, as you say, other races would say, well, we don't want the Klingons here either, so you can leave here too. And so we get this dilemma.
And couple that with the fact that at the beginning of the story, the Klingon Empire, Martok, and both believed that Todd was a major source of Topolene. It took Wu and his digging through the records to find how little of the mineral was actually being mined and shipped off planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there wasn't much. And Trial, he doesn't want to lose his position. So we have an interesting dilemma that falls on Worf's shoulders to try to solve, to save face for the Klingons, give the Al-Hamadi the freedom they want, and satisfy the Federation, who can come in and, or who aren't really interested in the planet to begin with.
No, they don't want to come in.
No.
They want Worf to take care of it. And the nice thing is that Worf comes up with a couple of plans that aren't going to work.
Right.
So it's not like the plan that he comes up with at the end is, okay, a no-brainer, I know what I'm going to do, here's how we're going to fix it. No, he's got to come to that conclusion through a couple of other ideas not working out.
Yeah. And, you know, the Al-Hamadi are fierce warriors in their own right. And they know how to do what they want to do. They play a game with the Klingons. Yeah, we're going to mine this stuff. And the leader loves the Klingons. Everybody wants the Klingons around. You know, we'll continue to work for you, but we're going to fight you too. And one way or the other, we're going to get rid of you. We're either going to kill you or you're going to leave. And of course, Klingons aren't going to leave. And there doesn't seem to be a solution that's going to be happy for everybody. Worf presents solutions to all parties, and you know, there's nothing there that anybody can agree on until he comes up with an idea.
Actually, if you recall, it's not so much he comes up with the idea as the technician, Val, is so disgruntled by how he's treated in engineering that he kind of drops this idea in their laps. Or yeah. At least when they say we need to have a new Klingon leader on this planet who's really a figurehead, he jumps up and says, hey, what about me? I've got no future here. I could easily be a figurehead.
Yeah. And now Val strikes me as kind of, as far as a Klingon character goes, he's a lot like Alexander.
Or step back a bit. The Klingon scientist on Enterprise.
Yeah.
The one that's working on the augment virus.
Yes. Val is brilliant. He can fix anything. And he actually saves the Gorkon several times.
And gets scolded for it every time, which is why he's disgruntled and volunteers.
Right, because Kurok is not happy with him at all, despite the fact that he takes the initiative to take care of things when they need to be taken care of.
And that's what she doesn't like.
Yeah. For instance, the Creel, which is another race that gets involved here, starts to attack the Gorkon. And Gorkon is having a lot of trouble with their shields as a result of this attack. Val gets up from his position and goes and fixes the shields for the ship, saving the ship, and actually allowing the ship to have to achieve victory against the Creel. Now the Creel were basically, they were, I guess Worf would have called them clop flies, because they weren't all that powerful, but they got a lucky shot in.
And they were contacted by the Al-Hamadi to try and help them kick the Klingons off.
Right. So anyway, you know, Val is, you would think that a person would be praised and uplifted for their initiative
achievement
to take care of this and their achievements as an engineer. As a matter of fact, he'd probably been a better chief engineer than Kurak, because Kurak was just didn't want to be there to begin with.
I think she could have been a really great engineer, but it was that apathy that kept her from being the great engineer.
Oh, yes. And this even gets carried forward in the Gorkon series, and we get a more of an idea of where she's coming from. But right now, she is all over Val, just doesn't want anything, doesn't want him around, doesn't want him to do anything, and she as much as tells him that.
Just short of killing him off.
Yeah. And he is so weak as a Klingon. He's not a warrior, he's not labeled a warrior, he's not considered a warrior.
He doesn't want to be a warrior.
And he doesn't want to be one, he wants to be an engineer. And he isn't even worth killing. But why would you want to kill the person that saves your ship?
Because he's showing up the chief engineer. He's doing things that he's not ordered to do that shows up her inefficiencies.
Yeah. And, you know, don't you want your people to step up and take care of things for you if you're a supervisor? Well, apparently not if you're a Klingon supervisor. You want to take all the glory. You want to take all the accolades. So.
Well, think about how Clagg is treating the medical officer on board. Was it Ortog or?
Odrek.
Odrek. I don't remember if it's this book or the next book. He literally smacks her across the face, breaking several bones because of her arguing with him.
Yeah. And she's been trained in medicine by Starfleet herself, and she can do him a lot of good.
She has lots of ideas.
Well, yeah. And one of the ideas, which goes absolutely 180 degrees opposite direction of what is normal, is that she wants to fit Clagg with a prosthetic arm, because at this point he does not have a right arm. He lost it in that crash.
But Klingons don't want prosthetics. So Clagg is continually saying no, 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 and doesn't agree to get it replaced until he can find a way to get an organic arm.
Well, and normally he wouldn't want any repairs made at all, because that battle scar that he has, that's an honorable thing to Klingons. They don't get their wounds healed. They want them on display. I mean, look at Martok. He lost an eye to the Jem'Hadar. He could have had that replaced, but Klingons don't do that. So she wants him to take a prosthetic. He is not going to take a prosthetic. He would never, ever live that down. His career as a Klingon warrior would be finished at the point he took a prosthetic.
In his mind. And he wants her to get rid of all the prosthetics she has stored in sickbay.
Yeah. And so that's what brings Clagg to hit her and treat her the way he does. Now, that resolves as time goes on. Things get better between the two of them.
More shipboard conflict, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's conflict all over the place here. So then, now Worf is presented with this unique solution to this problem that kind of solves everything. Vral is going to be a figurehead leader. He is going to become the governor of the planet. Trial is going to leave, and he's not honorable to begin with, and so he's gonna face some problems when he gets home. Vral is going to be a figurehead. Ray Trenat is going to take over the planet as the
Vol is going to become the emperor.
That's right. Yeah, Vol is going to take,
because there's a discussion in there of Val needs to change his name to Magrat because all the emperors are called Magrat.
Yeah.
But Val says, no. And what's interesting is Val is going to be a figurehead. Val is going to sit off to the side and just take credit and all. And the first thing he does when they have a planetary meeting is pull a chair up to the table and start making suggestions.
Yes. And they're good suggestions.
Well, yeah. He's an engineer. He knows what he's doing.
Exactly. And they are, and this is accepted. So Worf has found a way to keep a Klingon presence on the planet.
Keep the Topalene being mined.
Val is the only one. The Topalene is going to continue to flow.
Yes, the Topalene must flow.
Yes. and everybody's happy with this because appearances have been kept up.
And it's going to keep the rest of the galaxy from revolting against the Klingon Empire.
Yes. So it's a good solution. Worf can go on to Kronos and start going hunting with Martok. And everybody's happy. So what kind of themes do we have running through here? As we always do with a Klingon story, we have honor.
Always.
Always honor. Is there anybody who does not have... Well, I suppose we should say that Clegg is also finally convinced at the end that Worf is okay.
Well, some of the concepts that we've got going in this story is honor. But how do you captain a crew that is not of your choosing?
Well, and then that's kind of taken care of in the epilogue.
Well, see, the thing is, you've got stories like this where Clegg finds a way to do it.
Yes.
But then you've got stories like the Caine Mutiny, where Captain Kui doesn't.
That's kind of a two-sided story. That's an entire hour of discussion, just the Caine Mutiny would be.
But I'm just bringing it up here to show the dichotomy that you could have in what could happen.
Wouldn't, you know, just as an aside, wouldn't the Caine Mutiny make an interesting Klingon story?
It's tough to say because the members of the crew of the Caine were convinced that they had to do something about their captain. Only one of them, who was not the captain, was kind of wishy-washy about actually making the stuff happen. So if the first officer decided that the captain of the ship was incompetent, you're going to start having a battle, and if the first officer loses, the second officer starts the battle, and it's just a fight story.
Yeah. When I think, I got to watch that again one of these days. Anyway, Clegg.
Make sure you're eating strawberries when you do it.
Yeah, the strawberry caper. Clegg reassigns Drex to another post to get rid of him.
Off ship.
Off of his ship, yes. No longer first officer.
In fact, I think it was something non-defense force, wasn't it?
Right.
Not on the front lines.
Yeah. And Drex goes and complains to Martok.
Who tells him to accept it.
Martok says, well, swallow it and go find your honor. You know, pull your socks up, wipe your nose, and get on with it.
This ain't the first time Drex has had this happen. We've seen at least this and his dagger being taken from him on DS9. So.
Mm-hmm. And Leskit goes back to the Rotaran.
For how long?
Yeah, not very long, apparently.
Because he shows right up in It's a Good Day to Die.
Yes. Kurak thinks she's going to get reassigned, but sorry, no. Clegg informs her she is going to continue in her post.
Yeah.
Yep. She isn't happy about that, and she's also not happy about Leskit going away. But they do part amicably, and we'll get back together again.
No, they don't. She gets over him.
Well, she does, but he doesn't get over her.
Spoilers, but in A Good Day to Die, she picks up with somebody else.
Yeah, well, yeah, but he never gets over her.
True.
Yeah.
He wants to, but it's not as hard, fast a relationship as you would see in a traditional American love novel.
Yeah, we will see that come up again. Let's see.
Another concept is thinking outside the box to come up with a solution, because that's what Worf's got to do. Klingons do not play at war, do not play at conquering.
No.
Do not feign ruling. But here they've got to feign ruling to keep the planet.
That's because we have Worf, who is
thinking outside the box.
An evolved Klingon. In other words, you know, Worf, not only one of the complaints about Worf by many other Klingons is that he holds too many human values. And of course he would. He was raised by some very nice people, you know.
But the thing is, when you've got a person who's got a common sense system that comes from more than one culture, that's seen how other people can do things, they tend to be able to think outside the box and find a different solution to the problem when they're presented with it.
Right.
It's why travel broadens the mind, the way I think it was Mark Twain said.
Well, see, Worf has to go in, and he is the Federation ambassador to the Klingon Empire. So he must keep the Federation's interests also at the center of what he does, which is opposite of what probably the Klingons would have done, which is send in three or four ships and just wipe everybody out, wipe out all the Al-Hamadi, and then move forward.
You know, the easiest way to mine all this Tobaline on this frozen planet would have been to send in a fleet of ships, use the warp drive to reduce the gravity on a bunch of asteroids, drop the asteroids on the planet, wipe out the population, blow the planet into tiny pieces, and pick up the Tobaline.
Yeah, that wouldn't have made for a very good book.
No, it wouldn't.
Very short book.
But it's a solution to the problem. Another concept is, how do creative people deal with authoritarianism? You have the example of Val and Kurek. You have the example of Clegg and, blowing the name on the doctor again. Obrad or whatever her name was.
Odrak, yeah.
Odrak. So, you know, what do you do if you're a creative person? You've got these really good ideas, but your superiors are not going to let you carry them out.
Well, you know, that happens in everyday life. And what do? There's one of two things you can do. If you are working for a boss who is not going to give you any room for creativity or any room for initiative, you either have to accept that and go on, or you find another job.
And out in the middle of space, and you're the only ship there, you don't have much of a choice.
No, but Val does manage to find another job.
And Odrek manages to find a way to deal with Clegg.
Mm-hmm. So, and it's Clegg's idea, actually, because he finds out his father has died.
Oh, that's not the only thing, Jim. I mean, she's got other things she wants to do. She wants to improve the entire Klingon medical system, bring it up to Starfleet standards. She's trying to prove, and it doesn't come out until later stories, but she's wanting to prove to the Klingon hierarchy that if they heal their warriors, they can come back and fight again. She's got to prove that to them.
You're going to have a hard time convincing a Klingon to allow themselves to be healed and and not have scars to show for battles.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That's the problem she's facing. How she deals with it. How she overcomes these barriers in her way is what becomes interesting.
Yeah. And Clegg is at least open to the idea of getting his arm replaced, not with a prosthetic though. It's gotta be some sort of donor giving him an arm. And it just so happens that Marak dies, and then Clegg sees two things that can come out of this. First of all, he can get his arm back, which he's discovered he has to have. Otherwise, he's not going to be able to fight battles like he did against the Jem'Hadar again.
It's actually that Jem'Hadar battle on the holodeck, and when he ramped it back up to a real simulation and kept losing, that convinced him, yeah, I got to do this.
Yeah.
This is not one arm. My off arm is not working as a really good defense thing.
No. And he also comes to the realization that he can possibly restore his father's honor and by extension his own honor to his father, because he was behaving dishonorably towards his father also. And he can help Marak also restore his own honor by using his arm to do that.
But all this is the stuff that the doctor is going to have to develop, going to have to demonstrate, going to have to prove to a culture that doesn't want this proven to them.
No.
That it can be done. It's like Val has to prove his worthiness to Kurek in what, well, let's face it, Val goes in and he fixes the replicators, and the crew is eating food they like. And she comes down on him because he was not told to touch the replicators.
Yeah.
The crew's been miserable for months, and he fixes it.
Well, they'd have been dead if he hadn't tinkered with the shields.
Yeah. So, you know.
Now, you have another point here. What do you do with a prize that is economically meaningless but philosophically important?
If you can't get a decent supply of topoline off the planet to make the planet really economically worthwhile, why are you keeping it? Well, you're keeping it for a philosophical concept that once you're conquered by the Klingon Empire, you don't get released.
No, and you have a drain on resources.
But the drain on resources is not as harsh, not as much of a problem as other planets who have been conquered seeing you get away and thinking they can do the same thing.
Yeah. So you've kind of, I guess you might say, you've painted yourself into a corner here. With you know what you don't need, but you got to keep it because you have to save face.
Which brings up the theme side of it, of what would you give up for peace? That's the question. It's not a question Klingons ask so much, because they don't think in terms of giving up something to acquire peace. They think more in terms of smashing the enemy to get peace.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you subjugate them. You make them Yegwe Poo. But, you know, what happens when your Yegwe Poo start to rebel?
Well, you drop an asteroid on them.
Yeah, that'd be one solution.
But that's, you know, that's usually, in fact, I kind of wondering why Clegg didn't suggest that as an alternative, as a way of dealing with it. You know, if these guys aren't going to cooperate, blast them into oblivion.
Well, that's because Clegg is an honorable Klingon, and he is going to follow orders. And he knows, because Martok told both him and Worf, the goal of this mission is to find a solution that everybody can live with. And it is in everybody's best interest.
which shows that Clagg is not your traditional Klingon either. Because despite his heavy, in what we would think of as his heavy-handedness in dealing with his crew, somebody like Doric would have thought, why don't we just smash these people back into nothingness? Mm-hmm. You know, train the ship's phasers, disruptors, on the planet, especially the large cities, devastate them to where the rebels have no place to hide, can't do anything. I mean, we can always find other ways to get the Topolene out, but come up with a strong military solution.
Yeah, but when you have the Federation involved, that's not going to happen, because you could very easily trigger a war.
Well, that's why I said Clagg had to be a slightly, at least slightly non-traditional Klingon officer to not immediately go to those type of tactics.
Yeah. Well, and see, now this brings up a question in my mind is, have we seen all through Star Trek only one side of Klingon society? And this has come up before. We're not seeing one side of Klingon society, but we're seeing Klingon society through the eyes of the Federation, where the Federation is, all right, Klingons are nothing but a bunch of bloodthirsty warriors. That's all they care about, is fighting and killing and that kind of thing, where that's not actually the case.
Well, actually, if you look at books like the fourth book of Day of Honor, I'm blanking on the name of it, and they're talking about the farmers on that planet. Right. They're actually fighting a crop out of the ground.
Yes.
So that is deeply, that fighting mythos is deeply ingrained into their culture.
Yeah. Well, when you do something, if you are a Klingon, whatever your job is, it doesn't matter what it is, you do it with passion.
Yeah. You attempt to conquer the mission that you've been given. If that sink is leaking, you conquer that pipe.
Yeah. So what Keith is showing us is Klingon society from another point of view, and we see that Klingons are ambitious. It's just the way they go about, but the way they go about things aren't all that different, depending on who is doing the thinking. Clagg, I call Clagg kind of an evolved Klingon. He is going to command his ship with a very firm hand, but he's also thoughtful.
Yeah.
And he's willing to look outside of what would be normal and come up with solutions to problems that are more logical.
See, what you're touching on here is the persistent problem that writers have writing about species that are not human. How do you think, in terms of the world in a non-human perspective, how do you keep from anthropomorphizing your characters?
And well, it's almost impossible, isn't it?
I mean, in the case of the Klingons, do we not put them in the guise of the samurai or the Vikings?
Yeah, I would say more the Vikings.
Well, no, you've got the samurai elements there too. I mean, it's a combination of the two of them. But still, it's an Earth culture that we're imposing on them, because to come up with a truly alien way of thinking is quite hard to A, do, and B, to describe to your reader.
Yeah. Well, and then from a reading standpoint, from the standpoint of the person who's going to buy the book, you've got to give them familiar points of reference. Otherwise, nobody will understand it.
And let's face it, in writing books of this type, especially with Star Trek, are we not trying to shine a light on a very human concept to try and get people to think about that concept?
Yes. Yes. Precisely.
I mean, almost every original series story was something to do with things that were going on in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to get across the point of view while being entertaining.
Yes. Morality plays.
Well, Wagon Train to the Stars. That's how Gene pitched it.
Yeah. Well, and you can't blame him because Wagon Train was pretty darn
popular.
Wagon Train was pretty darn popular in those days. So, well, why don't we move on to closing thoughts and see if we can wrap this up.
Is there anything we haven't touched on?
Well,
that we can close with?
I don't know. I thought this was an amazing look into Worf as a diplomat and how he handles a situation outside of the warrior's nature. You know, it's not surprising he didn't continue, though, as a diplomat, because he really struggled through this. And that is not my idea of what a Klingon warrior wants to accomplish. They want to fight for battle. They want to fight for glory. They want to fight for honor. And all this little moving about and stuff like that just doesn't seem to be something that a warrior would want to have anything to do with.
And yet, who is the Klingon ambassador in that trilogy of books that we just covered called Prey?
Yeah.
Worf's son.
Yes. And, well, and see, the difference between Worf and Alexander is Alexander had a lot of Kalar's influence in him. And she was a diplomat. Also, she could fight, but she chose to be a diplomat, and she pretty much, for the most part, turned her back on Klingon traditions. She was a non-traditional Klingon.
Yet, in the first story we see her in, she tries to go with a Klingon solution to the problem that she and Worf are faced with. The ancient Klingon ship coming out of a time loop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Worf that comes up with the human suggestion to not have to destroy the ship as it emerges.
Okay. I just had a thought. Something that you
should
do
not...
Should
we kill it? Do we need to kill it?
No. Something you do not want to do, whether it be as far as Star Trek is concerned, the Star Trek books are concerned, or even as a part of a society, is don't label people and don't put them into boxes. Expect the unexpected and respect people because they can think for themselves.
Yeah.
Now, whether they choose to do so or not, that's a whole different idea.
But the thing that makes Alexander a good diplomat is not only was his mother a diplomat and she had his early training, but his father, who he's trained by for a while, Worf, doesn't have the typical Klingon mentality, but the Federation way of solving things. So he's getting a vast dichotomy of ideas which he can later draw on when he becomes that ambassador.
Yeah. And it was a huge benefit. So there it is. Diplomatic Implausibility by Keith R.A. DeCandido, and the short story. I'll say it one more time. Please don't laugh at me. Lodni Pu Vav Pu Ye.
One thing I'd like to say in closing thoughts is Diplomatic Implausibility kind of read to me like the first book in the Harry Potter series read, in that it's the author finding their footage in that particular storyline with which to tell the later tales. Because we're going to see the Gorkon stories that Keith writes are a much higher caliber than what Diplomatic Implausibility came off as.
Yeah. Keith is just awesome with Klingons. So,
but he's getting better.
Yes. So, Next month, we're going to look at A Good Day to Die by Keith R.A. DeCanado, the first book in the IKS Gorkon series.
And it follows the Gorkon immediately after Diplomatic Implausibility.
Yep, and then we'll have three more books in that series following that. So we're pretty well set for the future. So thank you for tuning in and listening to us. Pass along the word to others that they can listen to us from CAG.org/podcast, and they can find us on iTunes. Not iTunes. It's not iTunes anymore. Why do I keep saying that? Apple Podcasts is where you can find us and download us. And for Bound by Honor, I am Judge M.
And I am Jorn.
Kapla. Kapla. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group book review podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kapla! Geez, what was I going to say?
Words.
Words.
You were going to say words.
Words.